Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. On February the 17th of 1801, Thomas Jefferson was elected to be the third president of the United States of America. He would be sworn in on March the 4th of that year. His being elected president, this historical anniversary, prompted some thoughts. I was looking at Thomas Kidd's book, Thomas Jefferson, A Biography of Spirit and Flesh, and I wanted to talk about the faith of Jefferson, because it is so easy for the modern political sphere, and actually even I want to expand that into the modern social media sphere, the cultural sphere, to weaponize the seeming atheism of Thomas Jefferson. But to do so is to not only demonstrate true historical illiteracy, it's also to demonstrate an antagonism for history in general. Jefferson had a nuanced faith, but he was never anti-Christian. He was also never anti-theist. He was not an atheist by any stretch of the modern imagination. He was a theist. He was a natural theist, to say the least. And so in my commentary, I want to explore this expansive view of a rationalistic faith that he had. In fact, he would coin the term Christianism because he believed in the moral tenets of Christianity and the teachings of Jesus Christ as a sound moral teacher. But he would go on to say that he would not believe in an orthodox institutionalized religion that was governed by a clerical hierarchy and that had to be guided by a clergy. He became a stalwart supporter of the scriptures, the Christian Bible, and a biblical faith. And he allowed for that because he understood that religious liberty came from the same God that he honored and owed moral accountability to. And I argue that that has to be the lowest level that we ought to hold all of our elected officials accountable to. Then from there we speak with Wes Smith. Vermont and Oregon are the latest states to consider laws that would allow for assisted suicide. And we have to have these conversations. Montana is moving in the right direction, but we need to reclaim the dignity of the human person at the level of state legislation across the country. And finally, we speak with John Cavadini, that how service is a fundamental part of the Christian experience, rooted in Christ's own words, that the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve as well. And because of that, it overflows from our faith in Jesus Christ. All this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, February 17th. It's the Feast of the Founders of the Order of Servites. Today's news brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need at visitingangels.com. Pope Francis remains in the hospital. He was admitted Friday for bronchitis and underwent several tests, which show he is battling an infection. Doctors are modifying his treatment plan. An update this afternoon said he no longer has a fever and received the Eucharist today. Stay tuned to EWTN News and Ave Maria Radio for any updates. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says he wants all the hostages held by Hamas to be released as soon as possible. Rubio telling CBS's Face the Nation that he's working closely with the Israeli government to secure the immediate release of the hostages, despite the agreement outlined in the ceasefire deal.
There are some that are supposed to be released coming up next weekend. We expect that to happen, but we'd like to see them all come out. We're not in favor of waiting weeks and weeks. Now, that may be the process that's in place because of the deal, but we would like to see them all out as soon as possible.
Israel is set to receive six more hostages held by Hamas on Saturday. The U.S. will hold talks with Russia tomorrow over ending the war with Ukraine. NBC's Richard Engel.
Today, Secretary of State Marco Rubio arrived in Saudi Arabia to meet the Russian side. On Sunday, President Trump said he'll be joining the process soon, meeting directly with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio will lead the delegation for the talks in Saudi Arabia. Ukrainian officials have apparently not been invited. There are several people injured after a Delta Airlines flight from Minneapolis crashed at a Toronto airport today. Paramedics say at least nine people are being treated, with one person in critical condition. Pictures and video show the plane upside down. Weather conditions at the airport are snowing. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. On February the 17th, 1801, the House of Representatives elected Thomas Jefferson over Aaron Burr after a tie in the Electoral College, naming him the third President of the United States of America in the Senate chamber of the Capitol. He would eventually be sworn in on March the 4th. I'd like to talk about Jefferson, and I also like to talk about what drove the man in terms of his beliefs and ideals. Because in modernity right now, we've seen that Jefferson's religious views have been weaponized as if he was an anti-Christian atheist whose ideals should have formed the founding of American structures and principles. Well, here's the thing. His religious views have sparked extensive debate, his alleged atheism, and this has become a political weapon. But critics attacked him viciously. Even today, they accuse him of being a stalwart atheist. The truth, however, history proves this. He took religion quite seriously. He wove it into his personal philosophy, but also his political philosophy and ideals. He was a man shaped by the Enlightenment, so he encouraged an inquisitive approach to everything, including religion. His nephew, Peter Carr, in 1787, received a letter from Jefferson, wherein he wrote, Question with boldness even the existence of God. But he wasn't saying don't believe in God. Rather, he would go on to say that reason was more pleasing to God than blind obedience. And frankly, he's right. A kind of voluntaristic God is contrary to the Christian narrative. He extensively read on religious topics, and he desired to explore this with every facet of his intellect, and also he engaged it with various faiths. David McCullough, the historian and author of John Adams, wrote, Jefferson was a deeply religious man, and though his faith was not what many might expect, his religion was based on reason. His belief in a God who had created a world that operated according to natural laws. His admiration for the moral teachings of Jesus, stripped of miraculous elements. So yes, he insisted that religion was a personal matter between an individual and their creator. He never shied away from discussing the subject publicly or even engaging how religion was an indispensable pillar to the support of the republic that they were building. So his own religious beliefs, complex and evolving, still had a core conviction in a benevolent and just God who remained steadfast. But he acknowledged uncertainty in certain theological matters. For example, he entertained the idea that perhaps not everything in the universe was purely material. He expressed a kind of willingness to accept that some of his views might be wrong, especially when it came to dogmatic religious claims. Henry Adams, another historian, the author of The History of the United States of America, writes about Jefferson. Jefferson's religious ideas were as much a product of the Enlightenment as of Christian tradition. He was skeptical of the institutional church and clergy. He preferred instead to trust his own reason and judgment in matters of faith. So, in his view, in Adams's view, such uncertainties were part of the human condition, and Jefferson seems that he might have agreed, because Jefferson famously noted that he would rest his head on that pillow of ignorance which a benevolent creator has made so soft for us. At the same time, however, he wasn't an intellectual bore. He wasn't lazy about his intellectual pursuit. He exhorted employing reason and faith. He wrote, I never considered a difference of opinion in religion as impairing the harmony of society. This was in his letter to Elbridge Gerry in 1799. So when interpreting Jefferson's statements on religion, it's essential to account for his unique use of language, the social context in which he wrote. His expressions of religious belief, while sincere, often couched in terms of Enlightenment philosophy, and it makes it challenging to categorize his view within a particular Christian framework, or even secular framework for that matter. He did believe in a God. He called God a benevolent governor. He called God the infinite power. He rejected traditional Christian doctrines. He seemed to have denied the divinity of Jesus Christ. He didn't want to believe in Jesus as God. And so the doctrine of the Trinity, the resurrection, original sin, he never abided by those doctrines. He called these theological innovations, and he believed that they distorted the true essence of Jesus' teachings. So he would be one of the pioneers of that notion of Jesus being a good moral teacher. But he would say this, the doctrines of Jesus are simple and tend all to the happiness of man, and he wasn't wrong. This was in his letter to John Adams, a devout Christian, in 1813. Jefferson admired Jesus for his moral philosophy, particularly for advocating universal love, kindness, and an objective moral standard. He believed that Jesus' teachings held timeless wisdom. And this is where his understanding of Christianity is a little nuanced, I should say. I'm not trying to defend it entirely, but we can admit that. He described himself as a Christian, but his definition of Christianity was unconventional. He said, I am a Christian in the only sense in which he, Jesus, wished anyone to be, and this is where he was wrong. Sincerely attached to his doctrines in preference to all others, and that's true, he had a complete loyalty to Jesus, but only in moral teachings. And so he would go on to say, ascribing to himself every human excellence and believing he never claimed any other. This was in his letter to Benjamin Rush in 1803. So yes, he embraced Jesus' moral teachings. He considered this a kind of rational creed, but he completely distanced himself from the supernatural aspects of Christianity. This kind of whitewashed historical Christianity, he called it Christianism. It was rooted in reason and ethics, but it wasn't a true ascent of faith to divine revelation. And so there's a distinction to be made. His relationship with organized Christianity was marked by the fact that he rejected institutionalized religion. He believed that clergy and the enterprise of theology corrupted Jesus' teachings, and so in his private work, he set to strip away the miracles and supernatural elements of the gospel. His Jefferson Bible, quote-unquote, this was a personal compilation of Jesus' teachings for him. And this was the reflection of his effort. He wanted to present a version of Christianity that was moral and would give you moral guidance and teachings, but was stripped of the supernatural. You take that aside, though, he remained completely supportive of the actual Bible's value, quoted from it copiously, and even acknowledged that it offered ethical wisdom for the nation. He helped promote the Virginia Bible Society, which provided Bibles to families who could not afford one. And in fact, he also said, children should be first taught to reason before engaging with religious texts. Now, regardless of his intent, he was right. The church was always saying this. Jefferson's religious views defy easy categorization. Joseph Ellis, the historian, author of Founding Brothers, wrote, Jefferson's religious beliefs were difficult to classify, but they were characterized by a strong commitment to principles of religious liberty. He had a skepticism about Orthodox Christianity, but he had an enduring faith in the idea of a benevolent creator. So more than just a person, a loving person who is an absolute God. So yes, he was a theist. A believer in a God who actively sustains the universe in love. He wasn't a conventional Christian, but he seemed to honor a kind of ethical accountability to nature's God. In his own words to Benjamin Rush in 1800, I have sworn upon the altar of God, eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. Edmund Morgan, the author of American Slavery, American Freedom, wrote, Jefferson's faith was more concerned with the moral teachings of religion than with doctrine. His rejection of traditional Christian orthodoxy was rooted in his belief in a rational universe governed by divine laws, and he retained a sense of moral obligation to a creator. So yes, his rejection of core Christian doctrines might have given him a certain category, maybe a Unitarian perhaps. His views represent a blend of Enlightenment rationalism, a kind of ethical monotheism, and it still, however, drove the biblical notion, Judeo-Christian principles, that undergird our understanding of religious liberty and individual liberty in this nation. And this is an approach that, for all its complexities, shaped the foundations of America and American religious freedoms. You know, those things in the Bill of Rights, especially the First Amendment, that we take for granted. So much so that when we look back to the Declaration of Independence in 1776, we see that that same man penned the words, the God who gave us life, gave us liberty at the same time. So this line emphasizes liberty, but it reflects his view in a benevolent creator, and that benevolent creator is the origin of all our human rights. And so to that end, I want to quote John Meekham again. In the book Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, he writes, Jefferson was no atheist, but he was certainly not anti-Christian. He believed in a God who had created a rational universe, who had endowed human beings with reason and the capacity for morality, but he rejected the divinity of Christ, the miracles of the Bible. Jefferson was a man of faith. Faith that was personal, rational, and independent of skewed doctrine in his mind. It would be irresponsible and historically illiterate to think that he was an anti-Christian atheist and anti-American. In fact, let us at the lowest level espouse reason when we explore our faith for the happiness of our nation. Stay tuned, I'm Marcus Peter.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically own shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry providing families nationwide with a better solution centered around whole health, spirit, mind, and body. Our members share their medical burdens within a faith-filled community. At CMF Curo, our members have access to a spiritual director, concierge services, and other health and spiritual resources. Find out if CMF Curo is a better solution for your family. Visit MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
On the next Epiphany.
I know your works. You are neither cold nor hot. Vanessa Denhagarmo here. Kendra Tierney Norton will join us to offer encouragement to stay faithful to God during trials. Even the apostles wavered. So we're not alone. Steve Ray wrote Upon This Rock, and we'll talk about the upcoming Feast of the Chair of St. Peter.
Epiphany, weekdays at noon. And be sure to catch past episodes in our archive at AveMariaRadio.net.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
My daughter told me she was published in a scientific journal as an undergrad. I'm so proud of her. The world needs Catholic physicists, and my daughter's going to be one of them.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest is Wes Smith, Chair and Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism. And we are talking about, well, really, the dignity of the human person. There are certain issues that have been brought to our attention. In particular, one of the things that has come to our mind is that the Montana Senate has passed a bill that would make physician-assisted suicide illegal. Wes, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
Thank you, Marcus, and hello to your listeners.
So let's talk about this. For a long time now, especially in Montana, the notion of physician-assisted suicide has been obfuscated under the guise of some kind of intellectual honesty when it comes to where the line ought to be drawn. But a recent bill might be able to shed true clarity on this.
Well, what happened was, maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago, there was an attempt in Montana to have assisted suicide declared a constitutional right in litigation, based on the privacy right of privacy in the Montana Constitution, as I recall. And a trial judge basically said, "Yep, it's a right. Assisted suicide is a right." And it was really a ideological opinion. Well, the Supreme Court of Montana wanted to do likewise, but as I recall, and it's a long time ago, they had one problem, that during the legislative discussions on this clause in the Constitution, they specifically said, we're not allowing assisted suicide.
Mm-hmm.
So the Supreme Court wasn't able to find a constitutional right under the Privacy Clause. So instead, they basically did this very muddled decision saying, and it was under the living will statute that, assisted suicide isn't against the public policy of Montana. They didn't say it was legal. They said it wasn't illegal.
Right.
And which can make it legal. And they said that consent is a defense. So if a doctor prescribed lethal drugs to a patient at the patient's request, that would be a defense to the charge of homicide, whatever the charge might be.
Right.
So there have been attempts since then, both to outlaw assisted suicide explicitly in public policy and to legalize it. None of them have passed, and this is the closest that I recall a bill coming. It passed the Senate. It still has to pass the House, and it has to be signed if it passes the House.
Right.
But it is a step forward. And West Virginia, in the last November election, passed a constitutional amendment outlawing assisted suicide. And that was the first actual proactive pushback against the death agenda since this whole reign of advocacy to legalize assisted suicide began, back in 92 and even before, mm-hmm. in the 80s.
And the clarity of this bill in terms of its language is making very clear that if it passes, Montana is going to be the second state, right? This is after West Virginia. And it's drawing some really hard distinctions. The language of, for example, an act by a physician of purposely and knowingly prescribing a lethal dose of medication to a patient that the patient may self-administer to end the patient's life. So it's leaving no wiggle room here, because prior to this, they could attempt to make distinctions such as after life support is withdrawn or dying because it's an unintended result of pain medication. But now, no, this is being made very clear. There has to be an explicit intent in doing so.
Yeah, I don't like the term medication because it's not meant to help anything. It's meant to kill, so I would call it poison, but, you know, whatever.
You're right.
And they also, I'm glad they put in the part about that it doesn't include comfort care medication, mm-hmm. Withdrawing from life support, because advocates of assisted suicide become very intellectually dishonest on these points. They say there's no distinction to be made when you take somebody off a respirator and assisted suicide, but that's not true. First, the United States Supreme Court, 9-0 in 1997, that's going back a ways, and Vacco v. Quill, said no, taking somebody off life support is not the same thing as assisted suicide.
Yeah.
Secondly, if somebody has the life support withdrawn, they aren't killed by drugs or poison. They die a natural death from their underlying injury or illness. Thirdly, sometimes when life support, life-sustaining treatment is withdrawn and someone is expected to die, they don't. So those are real distinctions to be made from assisted suicide, where the very purpose is to make somebody dead. You withdraw life support, the purpose is to not have that kind of onerous intervention that might no longer suit the patient. I'm sorry about that.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
Sorry, my dog agrees with me.
I was going to say the exact same thing. He seems to agree with what we're saying. Now, the horror of this is that while Montana is moving down this path, Vermont has swung to the other extreme. I couldn't believe it when I found out that.
Well, Vermont is probably the most radical of the assisted suicide legalizing states.
Yeah.
Followed by Oregon, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
Vermont allows people to get assisted suicide via telemedicine, in other words, internet conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Vermont does no longer requires that somebody receiving assisted suicide be a resident. Now, that's an attempt by the assisted suicide euthanasia activists to nationalize the agenda, which they can't do state by state, apparently. So they're having a couple of states, Oregon was the other one, do away with residency requirements, which was supposed to be one of the big guidelines to protect against abuse.
Right.
So, and now Oregon and Vermont both are saying, we're going to allow, they've got bills in the hopper. I would be surprised if they didn't pass, but we don't know for sure. They're going to say non-doctors, like physician's assistants or certified nurse practitioners,
mm-hmm.
can also prescribe death. Now, I love physician's assistants and certified nurse practitioners, but they are not certified doctors and specialists that you would want to attend to if you had that kind of a serious condition.
Yeah, especially when you consider the fact that this language is allowing for them to have a kind of carte blanche almost, because the language is also allowing for not ever seeing a doctor or having an in-person consultation or examination. So by telemedicine, you can speak to someone who's a non-doctor clinician. The language just simply says a non-doctor clinician, And now you're prescribed with these poison pills at your own leisure. There's a certain horror that ought to grip us when we consider that scenario.
Yeah, and the Oregon one says that a third person can pick up the poison.
Right.
So, I mean, people have to understand that there is a great con game being played here. The activists push this to, as a way of this, of not being in pain, terrible pain, when pain is rarely the reason people ask for assisted suicide. They say, we've got strict guidelines to protect against abuse. Well, those guidelines are very porous. They say it's only for suffering that cannot otherwise be eliminated, but the laws don't actually say that.
Exactly.
Once they're passed. And then they say, once it's passed, well, these guidelines that we created to protect against abuse are really obstacles, and they're barriers to a good death. So the process of opening up, liberalizing, making more people eligible begins. At least half the states so far that have legalized assisted suicide have expanded their law. And eventually it's going to go beyond terminal illness, because euthanasia and assisted suicide is not about terminal illness. It's about killing as a means of ending suffering.
Right.
And there are people who suffer far more than terminally ill people for far longer.
Yep.
And as we've seen in Canada, the Netherlands, Belgium, and so forth, those people will soon be allowed in once the death agenda takes hold of a culture. It has not yet taken hold of the American culture, and that's why we're sliding down that slippery slope much slower than other countries that have swallowed the hemlock culturally.
Yeah. And very, very Socratically put, I appreciate the dark sentiment there, because this is alarming. And if we're reading these bills rightly, the fact is there's an allowance for greater expansiveness, so that, like you mentioned, it's beyond just terminally ill individuals. Wes, thank you very much for making the time to speak with us about this.
Thank you very much.
My guest, Wes Smith, Chair and Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. We've been talking about human dignity, and right now in the medical sphere, with the push of assisted suicide in different states, while some states are moving in the right direction, we need to stay informed, we need to pray, we need to keep fighting for the dignity of human life. I'm Marcus Peter.
St. Andrew in Saline is a pre-K through 8th grade Catholic school offering a rigorous academic curriculum that focuses on spiritual growth in all things they do. Join them for their preschool and kindergarten open house to tour the school and meet the teachers. It will take place on Sunday, February 23rd from 1 to 3 p.m. To learn more, visit standrewsaline.org/school. Enrollment is open to everyone who's looking for a faith-based education.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes, without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
How would you like to celebrate the Divine Mercy at the Shrine of the Divine Mercy in Poland on Divine Mercy Sunday? Well, you can. Steve Ray here, inviting you to join us in Poland as we follow the footprints of John Paul II, Maria Faustina, and Maximilian Kolbe. Daily Mass at the most iconic, beautiful churches and delicious local foods. Join us in April for Divine Mercy Sunday in Poland.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net.
This week on Christ is the Answer, Father John talks about living as a Catholic in a post-Christian world. Cultures all over the world are turning against their own history. These once Catholic places are now openly against the Church and her teachings. They say it's in the name of freedom and inclusivity. But Father John asks, what do those words really mean? Join us this week as Father John talks about true freedom and the harms of relativism. Tune in for Christ is the Answer Monday through Fridays at 11 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
The Heart of the Interior Life with Elizabeth Jingle.
How does God act when a person moves closer to Him? St. Ignatius of Loyola writes in the second of his 14 rules for the discernment of spirits, "And it is proper to the good spirit to give courage and strength, consolations, tears, inspirations, and quiet, easing and taking away all obstacles, so that the person may go forward in doing good." God gives courage and strength to help a person continue to rise from good to better. God also gives consolations and tears. Consolation is a happy, uplifting movement of the heart that assists us in our service to the Lord. Tears reflect the working of God's grace within our hearts. God also gives inspirations that lead to spiritual clarity. He gives a quiet peace within the heart and an easing and taking away of all obstacles. So, as St. Ignatius says, that the person may go forward in doing good.
For more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. That's AveMaria.com.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Mark 10:45. This saying of Jesus illustrates to us that service is a crucial component of the Christian faith and the Christian life. It's the basis, or at least it provides the basis, for Christ's articulation of his vocation and work as the Son of Man. Joining me to talk about this reality of Christian service and its theological basis in the Christian life is John Cavadini, who is a professor of theology at University of Notre Dame, having served as chair from 1997 to 2010, and since 2000, he has served as the director of the McGrath Institute for Church Life at Notre Dame. John, great to speak with you. How are you?
Thanks very much. I'm great. How are you?
Very well, thank you, and really glad to be speaking with you. I'd like to open up this conversation at the grander scale. There's often a particular kind of sensitivity to talking about Christian service to the extent of negating the work of the kerygma. But the fact is, the teaching of the gospel is a both-and reality, that the way we work out and live out our faith is by means of this demonstrable work of service.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that people talk about service, though, often as though it were a moral imperative, which it is, but essentially disconnected from a theological, I guess you could say, motivation, mm-hmm. or as a kind of theological or Christological witness. And I think the two things have to be held together. It's both in, but you have to hold them together.
Right. And that holding together means that there is a theological driving force here. The end of all of our work ultimately has to be soteriological. It has to be salvation in the person of Jesus Christ. And so all of our service, while meeting anywhere from the immediate needs to the base needs of our fellow man, has as its final end their eternal salvation in God. So just comment on that for a little bit.
Sure. I think it's easy for Catholic service, even Catholic service projects, let's put it that way, to become one-dimensional and to speak in terms of social justice only. Nothing wrong with social justice, don't get me wrong. But I think if you speak only in terms of justice, you basically lose a connection to the theological justification for service.
Mm-hmm.
Because you end up giving the impression that a society, that the language of justice is enough to create a wonderful society, but it's not enough, because mm-hmm. Pope Benedict XVI himself said in his encyclical God is Love that you will never have a state you'll never have a state that's so just that it will eliminate the need for a service of love. And that service of love is precisely what's grounded in Christ bending down to us, the Word of God bending down to us in service. And so therefore, he said, whoever is preparing to eliminate love is preparing to eliminate humanity as such. You can't, so therefore,
If you're going to talk about the state or society in terms of justice only, you're basically eliminating human beings from the equation, because the deepest need of human beings is to be loved, and that need is fulfilled only, finally, by God. Yeah. That's what we call salvation. And therefore, our own works of love are intended to bear witness to and help people participate in that larger gift of love.
And so this language of being finally fulfilled in God is so crucial, because when we keep that teleology at the forefront of our mind, then we understand that all of these other ends for the work that we do are subservient to this final end in the person of Jesus Christ and in the beatific vision. And therefore, we can also then begin to understand that there's a kind of charity at play here, that the divine Lord is actively pouring his life out into us, that we may become vessels that pour that life out into others, this participation in Christ's great kenosis, so to speak.
That's exactly right. I think that if the church loses that, or if our service projects lose that dimension, there's almost no reason for the church to be offering them, because there's nothing distinctive about them then. I'm not saying that you engage in Christian service, in service outreach, the works of charity, in order to proselytize people directly. The church is not in favor of that. That is, some Protestant organizations do that. You know, you get a sandwich and you also get a sermon. That's not the idea here. The idea here is that there's a larger social vision that people have forgotten about, the social vision which John Paul II called the civilization of love. And it's that social vision that resists a one-dimensionality of certain kinds of utopianism or rationalism.
Yes.
That's basically what the church has to offer. And that larger witness will draw people, or is intended to draw people, into communion, into Eucharistic communion. That's the final end and goal, I guess you could say.
Right.
And the place in which we glimpse, well, the church is the sacrament of that ultimate vision.
And that's why, just based on what you've just shared, there is going to be an ultimate futility if the only perspective for all of our work of service is ordered towards temporal justice. I remember when I was in seminary, it was poor formation, to say the least. We were taught a particular kind of theology that heaven isn't at peace if we don't have earthly, and by this they meant socio-political, military, and material peace. And, I mean, first of all, talk about a bad notion of eschatology, but even more than that, to present this utopian perspective as if that is the end of the gospel at large, when in reality that kind of social justice is virtually impossible considering the reality of the fallen human nature.
Yeah, the point is really, ultimately, this life is a struggle.
Mm-hmm.
You can't eliminate it. It's because it's a struggle against evil. And you just can't, if you try to wash that out of the Christian life, you've basically made it insipid. You know, the salt has lost its saltiness. I forget how the Bible puts that exactly. But the thing is, the language of the church, militant, isn't used as much anymore because it sounds too militant to people. And I could understand that. But the church, the point is, it's that it's the church which is fighting against evil, and this is a deeply ancient insight. So that in all of the ancient martyr literature, for example, the martyrs are athletes for Christ, and the struggle is against, not in the ultimate sense against the Roman persecutors in the case of the ancient martyrs, but it's against the devil. And all the ways in which the devil tempts us to be unfaithful and unloving, both.
And what this presents us then is this great opportunity, especially for those of us who profess faith in Christ Jesus, that we will never be without an avenue for the outpouring of the love of God. And, you know, you're looking at Deus Caritas Est, and Benedict makes that very, very clear. Well, we're always going to have loneliness. There's always going to be people who are poor and in need of consolation and help in material need. And the church, it ought to constantly be there to respond. But the way in which she responds has to be as a first and foremost response to the love of God that's already been poured out into her.
That's exactly right. And the church is here as the sacrament of that love.
Mm-hmm.
And all the works of mercy that we do And remember, there's spiritual works of mercy too. It's not just the corporal works of mercy, though it is those, are supposed to be, I don't know, invite people into that mercy, and invite people into a mercy that's larger than ourselves and to which we're only bearing witness.
Yeah, and that's why we also want to be tremendously careful that this mercy and this work of justice that we do does not have the temporal world as its ultimate end, because that's going to frustrate human nature at the end, because human nature realizes it's made for a transcendent purpose. There's an eschaton that we're all hoping for, and all of our work ought to be ordered toward that, including the work of helping those in need.
It has to be, because the temporal order itself is ordered towards that.
Yep.
And, you know, the Book of Revelation talks about a new heavens and a new earth, so that everything is going to be renewed.
Yep. My guest, Dr. John Cavadini, professor of theology at the University of Notre Dame, and he has served as, where he has served as chair, and he's also served as the director of the McGrath Institute for Church Life at Notre Dame. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
The Wine Palace in Livonia is a proud sponsor of Ave Maria Radio. The Wine Palace is a family-owned business for over 60 years where customers come in for a great service. The 9,000-square-foot store includes a humidor, specialty wine room, and a rare and collectible spirits room. We have the largest selection of spirits in the state at the most competitive prices. Ask for one of the brothers, Cliff or Kelly, and thank them for their strong support of Catholic Radio. Delivery is available. Please visit the Wine Palace at I-96 in Middlebelt or at winepalacemi.com.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
The Catholic Church teaches that Jesus Christ is literally and wholly present, body and blood, soul and divinity, under the appearances of bread and wine. Feeding 5,000 from a boy's 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, as recorded in John chapter 6, is quite a miracle. Yet the next day, Jesus downplays it in verse 27. Do not work for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures for eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. Likewise, God's provision of manna to the Israelites in the desert was also a great miracle, yet Jesus similarly downplays it in verse 49. Your ancestors ate the manna in the wilderness, but they died. This is the bread that comes down from heaven, so that one may eat of it and not die. Jesus is clearly stating that his Eucharist is greater than both of these amazing miracles, and the Catholic Church absolutely takes him at his word. Examining the truths of the Catholic faith, this is faithforensics.org.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Does your family make regular time to work, play, talk, and pray together every day? Research shows that when Catholic families create strong, consistent daily rituals for working, playing, talking, and praying together, they set the stage for teaching their kids Christian attitudes toward work, leisure, relationships, and faith. If it's true that values are more caught than taught, family rituals are what makes a Christian worldview truly contagious. That's why the rite of family rituals is such an important part of the liturgy of domestic church life. It helps families come together as strong domestic churches and learn what it means to be intentional disciples at home and in the world. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Hi, I'm Ed Bahura. We understand the unique challenges of homeschooling, and we are here to support you with expert private tutoring tailored to your child's needs. Whether it's math, science, or reading, Sylvan Learning is here to help your child excel and build confidence. Our experienced tutors make learning fun and effective, while our flexible scheduling fits into your busy homeschool routine. Call 1-800-EDUCATE.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
I've seen the difference in my son since he's been at Ave Maria. He's happy, he's excited about what he's going to do with his degree, and he's living his faith.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest, Dr. John Cavadini, professor of theology at the University of Notre Dame. We are talking about a sound theology of the Christian life of service. So, John, I'd like to return to that thought that you left us with, which is that the temporal order, by its very nature, points to an eschatological purpose. It points to a transcendent reality. Nature, creation, doesn't pretend to be an end in itself, and nor should we treat it that way.
No, it's like the world is created for the glory of God. That's the purpose of the world. And so the world, you could say, is almost groaning in its, that's the way Scripture talks about it, in its growth pains in order to proclaim the glory of God. And so the world itself is ordered towards that glory. And we're in the works of mercy that we do, we're supposed to participate in, really, in the ordering of our world, our temporal world, as towards the glory of God, and to help other people be oriented in that direction. Because otherwise, what do you have? You just have a world that seems to be running down. You have a world that ends in death for each person. So, you know, what's the point, in a sense? If the temporal order is enclosed in itself, there is no point.
Right. Because this isn't ever going to be a closed system. The pretense, or at least the facade, of presenting this narrative that if we fix everything on earth, everything will be fine, is self-defeating, because at the end, even that which we fix will wind up encountering the threshold of death. And at that point, this question for hope, for meaning in human life, for even the purpose of our material wealth and possessions, all of these things come to the forefront as a question all over again.
That's exactly right. I also wanted to point out, maybe, I don't know if I should be doing this, but I wanted to point out that there's a kind of Marian dimension to this.
Mm.
If you look at Mary's Magnificat, she talks about, it's not even the Magnificat. If you think about the mystery of Mary as Mother of God, she orders our attention, right, not to something abstract, a theological concept called the Incarnation, though I believe in that. That's not the point, though. She reminds us that the Incarnation is a person, right,
right,
who was a baby. It's very concrete. And that means that that ultimately we have to think of the works of mercy as personal, as like, and that's the primary sphere in which we operate. It's not the systemic. I'm not against thinking of systemic reform, but a lot of people, I think that systemic reform is the only meaningful way to think about social justice or social service or charity. But in the end, it's the personal that's primary. Mary shows us that. She receives the one who is the logos, the meaning of everything, of all of creation, mm-hmm. into her heart and into her womb, and takes care of him as a baby, and invites us to think of him and to think of the self-emptying of the Word,
right,
as something concrete. And, you know, it went that far, that Jesus was in the need of having all of his needs met by Mary. And so this is the primacy of the personal in terms of view of service that Mary shows us.
And even as you're talking, I'm reminded of Paul's great kenosis hymn, which exemplifies, first of all, Christ's outpouring of himself and great emptying of himself. But there's a kind of Marian mirror here that, and therefore there's a kind of mirror for all of us Christians, that if we follow the path of Jesus Christ in this emptying of self, in this pouring out of self, making ourselves self-gifts to others, as Ratzinger constantly reminds us to do throughout his papacy, but Deus Caritas Est is an exemplary version of that. We are awaiting the glory that is to be fulfilled in our Lord. And so Mary has been elevated to the heights of heaven. Christ has been given the glory as King of Kings, that every knee shall bow, every tongue confess Jesus Christ as Lord, to the glory of God the Father. So the point in all of this is our work in Christian service, if we have a sound theology of it, must be an emptying of self, because it is first and foremost a reception of what God has poured into us. But the more we empty ourselves, the more we actually receive from the Lord, which is the great mystery of Christianity to begin with.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And keep in mind, now you're bringing up the mystery of Mary, Queen of Heaven and Earth. Keep in mind that what was assumed into heaven wasn't a system. And as Queen of Heaven and Earth, she's not queen of a system. She's not. It hasn't been made into a heavenly political system. That's not the point. What she's queen of is the personal, the personal domain of love that Jesus inaugurated, and in his messianic rule is now ruling over, though it will come to its completion later. But to say that Mary is Queen of Heaven and Earth is to say that. Is to talk about the primacy of personal witness, of person-to-person care, like her care of Jesus. And that's what finally bears witness and creates a civilization of love.
You know, I love that you mentioned that. I'm still actually internally chuckling at that sentiment, because you're completely right. Ratzinger cautions us about this in Deus Caritas Est. He alludes to this exact same issue in Caritas in Veritate. And the problem that we can immediately run into when we talk about anything pertaining to social teachings is that the kindness of the church, the compassion of the church, even the language of the church, can be co-opted by progressivist ideals and systems that claim to provide an avenue for a materialist utopia. And so these languages of the common good, of subsidiarity, solidarity, they all sound good even on the secular level, but it's when they are presented as systemic, as ends, systems unto themselves, that we've completely missed the forest for the trees.
It's true. Look, you have an evil system. If you're gonna fight it systemically, you are gonna end up with another evil system. Like,
right.
Unless you see something deeper than politics, unless you see something deeper, I hate to say it, but deeper than justice, you're gonna end up with a zero sum or a closed system, not open to transcendence, and that is the erasure of the human being as the human being.
Right. And that's why every single economic system or sociological system that has purported a means of transcending the material order, creating this kind of utopia, I keep utilizing that term, it really winds up being a utopos. It's a thing that doesn't exist. It attempts to erase the human person in the process, and it fails in all and succeeds in neither.
I should make a clarification, though. I just was listening back into my head to what I said. I don't equate all political systems as equal.
Yes.
So I don't mean to say that, you know, one system is as evil as another. I don't think that's true. But I'm trying to make the point that if you limit yourself to systemic reaction against systems, you're not going to release yourself from ultimately from materialist way of thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, and therein lies the issue that this is the entire thrust of the doctrine on the common good, and the entire thrust of subsidiarity, and even solidarity, the notion that this is about the dignity of the human person. This is about individuals having indescribably infinite value in their infinite creator.
There is no system in and of itself that can bear witness to that. It must be the gospel.
And that's alarming for all of us, and yet what a clarion call. Because that also means that the little good that we do within the small spheres that we have possess eternal value, and that's what Christian service looks like at the level of the church.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know if you know who Dorothy Day is, I'm sure, but you probably knew that Dorothy Day also wrote a biography of the Little Flower of Thérèse Lisieux. She wrote that biography because she said that it's, she wrote it for people who feel futile, for Catholics who feel futile, you know, that the gestures of love that they do in their life go nowhere because they've been convinced by systemic thinkers that it's worth nothing.
Right.
She said she wrote the book exactly for that purpose. And she said there's more power in one act of grace than in a whole hydrogen bomb.
Wow. Yeah, I think I vaguely recall that quote. We own a copy of that biography of St. Thérèse. And I... We're so tempted by the material order, so tempted by the secular narrative, to say that the only difference we can make is the kind that creates ripples across the world. And when we think that way, we are already thinking in such a limited secularist manner that defeats the gospel teaching, the biblical teaching, the Christian teaching of the value of the human person.
Yeah, because we started thinking, well, I have to change the system, and then we start ignoring the person who needs a cup of cold water.
Right, right. And
but it's not big enough, it's not grand enough, so my attention isn't there anymore.
To quote from, I believe it's from that same book, that the vanity of Eve was the desire to exercise power, to seduce, to drag down. Talk about the fact that this is a temptation from the garden all over again. And yet, the Christian really finds himself when he makes a complete gift of himself. Not at the desire of accruing power, but at the service of one another and ultimately of God.
You know, the Gaudium et Spes makes that point in the Second Vatican Council in chapter 22, or the most famous chapter in it, I hope, mainly, anyway, where he says that the vocation of the human being is fully revealed only in Jesus Christ, who emptied himself. And insofar as he revealed, he who had everything, he was God, emptied himself, he reveals that our vocation is to do likewise in him.
Yep. And to echo Gaudium et Spes again, and ultimately the vocation of man is known primarily and most fully in God. And so the only way we're going to find ourselves and what we're meant to do is to pursue God in the first place. So all of our work of service will mean nothing, even if we feel compelled within, if we're not discerning first what is the call of God for each and every one of our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we also have to remember, I said this before, but I want to emphasize that the spiritual works of mercy are equally important as the corporal works of mercy, and including instructing the ignorant and bearing wrongs patiently. Those kinds of things have a lot of power, but we don't necessarily unleash it.
Yeah. John, thank you so very much for making the time to speak with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
My guest, Dr. John Cavadini, professor of theology at the University of Notre Dame. We've been talking about having a proper theological concept of our lives of Christian service. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.